طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Lately, given the events at Charlottesville and all its fallout, and given the Trump administration's ongoing aid and comfort to the right-wing racist, fascist, and militia movements, we hear of the increased open expressions of racism and anti-Semitism throughout American society. Most of us think that these racist and anti-Semitic expressions are attacks on a separate people, but that is not necessarily the case. Take the case of Leslie Williams, an Afro-American of the Jewish faith. Obviously, she has unique experiences and a unique take on what is happening on our streets and in our communities. I'm going to read the text of a speech given by Leslie Williams at a call to renewed action against racism and neo-fascism held by the Resist, Reimagine, Rebuild Coalition of Chicago. Leslie spoke on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace, Chicago, one of the member organizations of the coalition. Here is what she said, and I offer it because it is both thought-provoking and profound, speaks to the intersectionality we need to promote, and exposes concepts we need to deal with in this society, including the inclusion of the Palestinian struggle for their country in this discourse. Leslie Williams said in her speech, and I quote, "I stand here today as a Jew by choice and the child and grandchild of the great migration in which millions of African Americans fled racist terror in the South, only to encounter redlining, discrimination, and police violence in the North and the Midwest. Like all of you, I have mourned and raged over the overt racism and anti-Semitism seen in Charlottesville. I have watched in horror as avowed racists defiantly parade in Klan robes and swastikas. I have listened to the anguish of Holocaust survivors and their descendants as they are forced to confront the historic trauma of the Nazi era. As both a Jew and an African American, I recoil from the white supremacy and anti-Semitism on display this week. I have been gratified to hear Jewish leaders and organizations call for the destruction of racism, speaking eloquently about the shared history of oppression Jews and African Americans have faced. Yes, I confess to a certain discomfort in the many appeals to recognize the twin evils of anti-Semitism and anti-black racism in Charlottesville. I've thought about this a lot over the past week, and here's what I've realized. For Jews, Nazi symbols evoke a terrifying, traumatic past. For African Americans, they evoke a terrifying, traumatic, unending present. White Jews may be shocked at this undeniable evidence of U.S. racism. African Americans merely see more of the same. Black people did not need to be reminded by hoods and swastikas that we live in a dangerously racist country. White Jews are not under the same level of threat as people of color. In short, white Jews need to accept that they are white, and that whatever harassments or humiliation they may experience from anti-Semites, they nevertheless dwell under the all-encompassing shelter of white privilege. Police do not murder them in custody. Their votes are not systematically undermined. They do not overwhelmingly live in poverty or adjacent to poverty. The two documented lynchings of American Jews, though horrific, pale in comparison to the nearly 4,000 lynchings of black women, men, and children in U.S. history. The lifestyle and life expectancy of the average white Jewish American is not materially different from that of white non-Jewish majority. There is no institutional anti-Semitism. Furthermore, white America is generally more accepting of discussing and acknowledging the history of anti-Semitism than they are the currency of anti-black racism. As James Baldwin wrote in the classic 1967 essay, one does not wish, in short, to be told by an American Jew that his suffering is as great as the American Negro's suffering. For it is not here, and not now, that the Jew is being slaughtered. The Jewish travail occurred across the sea, and America rescued him from the house of bondage. But America is the house of bondage for the Negro, and no country can rescue him. For white Jewish Americans, the U.S. has always been the promised land. Yet African Americans know it is Pharaoh's Egypt. Not only do white Jews of good conscience need to acknowledge that they are not the primary victims of white supremacy, they need to look at how their own institutions have not only failed to challenge, but in some cases are openly complicit in its preservation. For example, the Anti-Defamation League, which presents itself as a champion of civil rights and tolerance, once spied against the NAACP and the African National Congress. A 1993 lawsuit regarding the ADL's extensive spying on Muslim, Arab, anti-apartheid, and other political activists also reveals that the ADL spied on and passed information to South African authorities on African National Congress leader Chris Hani shortly before his assassination. As JVP points out in our Deadly Exchange campaign, the ADL and other Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Congress, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and Chicago's own Jewish United Fund all organize police, ICE, and Homeland Security training exchanges in which American and Israeli police officers share tactics of oppression, teaching each other the aggressive, militarized police strategies which have led to the deaths of African Americans like Philando Castile, Freddie Gray, and Laquan McDonald, and Palestinians such as Mahmoud Khalif Lafe, Omar Ahmed Lufti Khalil, and Shiham Rateb Rashid Nimar. Meanwhile, according to their own tax filings, many cities' Jewish federations, including Chicago's Jewish United Fund, contribute generously to groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified as leading anti-Muslim extremists, groups like the Middle East Forum and the Investigative Project on Terror, which laid the intellectual groundwork for Trump's Muslim ban. It is no coincidence that these groups are all tremendously supportive of Israel's brutal policies toward Palestinians. All of this is done in the name of Jewish security, either in the United States or in Israel. So I ask my white Jewish friends and family, Is the perceived safety of people who look like you worth the continued oppression, incarceration, and murder of people who look like me? Last summer, when African Americans challenged white America to support the platform for Black Lives, nearly every Jewish organization in the country condemned its indictment of the genocidal oppression experienced by Palestine in Israel. None was more critical, dismissive, and patronizing than Jonathan Greenblatt, the president of the ADL, who urged African Americans to, quote, keep our eyes on the prize, unquote, and remember that it is Jews, not African Americans, who know from genocide. I hope that the obscenity of Charlottesville will lead all Americans to examine their complicity in tolerating institutional oppression. But in particular, Jewish Voice for Peace calls on our own Jewish community to condemn and disavow our organizational support of racism and Islamophobia, both past and present. We must embrace a vision for safety that does not come at the expense of communities of color. Only then can we truly claim to stand together in genuine, rather than merely symbolic, solidarity. That was a speech delivered at a rally in Chicago by Leslie Williams, an Afro-American of the Jewish faith and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. Okay, now on to our feature presentation. This morning we feature a speech given by Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi during Columbia's Anti-Apartheid Week beginning March 1st, 2017. His topic, Palestine in the Age of Trump. First, the introduction, followed by the presentation.
So thank you so much for coming out to Columbia University Apartheid Divest, third event of our annual Israeli Apartheid Week. I'm going to introduce our speaker. So Professor Rashid Al-Khalidi is the Edward Said Chair in Arab Studies at Columbia University. From 1987 to 2003, he was a professor of Middle East History and the director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Chicago, where he taught. So without further ado, can we give a warm welcome to a very special speaker, Professor Rashid Al-Khalidi.
Thank you. With a government firmly in power in Washington today that has a profound and deep disdain for Palestinian rights, and that is far closer to the right-wing leadership of Israel than any administration that has come before it, I think that Palestine currently confronts a very daunting reality, Palestine and the Palestinian people. Now, this is not entirely new. In recent years, the ascendant political currents in the United States and in Israel had already begun to merge. I would argue that in some ways, we are almost one country. There's been an ever-increasing flow from one country to another in both directions of political consultants, political operatives, public relations expertise, campaign contributions, security and intelligence expertise, high-tech firms, capital, investment, and many, many other things. U.S. laws are increasingly made according to Israeli desiderata. The Israel lobby often kindly provides the drafts of these laws, which overburdened members of the House and Senate frequently adapt and pass unchanged. They once mistakenly actually tabled a bill, I believe it was in the House, which the facts of AIPAC and its address were at the top, and they just put it down as a member's bill. It was actually an AIPAC bill. It was passed, of course. Politicians have long proclaimed that the values of the two countries are identical, American and Israeli values are identical, and that there cannot and must not be any daylight at all between their policies. Their policies must be identical. So we're not the same country quite yet, but these are indicators of the fact that the currents, the leading or the dominant political currents in both countries are in fact, beginning to merge. I'm arguing tonight that this process has now reached its apogee under those perfectly suited soulmates, Donald J. Trump and Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu. Both men harbor pronounced authoritarian tendencies. Both have a contempt for legal niceties. Both are hostile towards the role of the press in a free society. And both have a barely concealed racism towards the minorities in their respective countries. Both are inveterate bullies who regularly employ the language of threat, force, and bluster. We're probably more familiar with our own president, but both of them really are similar in all of these respects. They are supported, sustained politically, and advised by members of the same class of reactionary billionaires, with casino magnate Sheldon Adelson perhaps the most prominent individual on that long list. He's one of the biggest supporters of Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's one of the biggest supporters of President Trump. And he certainly is a reactionary billionaire, though Trump has a long list of them, many of them now cabinet secretaries. Once upon a time, it wasn't that long ago, America's solicitous concern for Israel and its casual disregard for the Palestinians was deceptively cloaked behind a pretense of even-handedness. Once upon a time. It's almost a fairy tale now. Today, under Trump, we're already seeing an even more complete convergence between the U.S. political leadership and the most chauvinistic, the most religious, the most settler-dominated right-wing government in Israel's entire 68-year history. It will be this Israeli government, and it will be its new American partners in Washington, who will attempt to call the tune in Palestine for the next several years. Now, we were able to get a glimpse of the future that these two sides, the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government, envision for Palestine and the Palestinians during the recent Trump-Netanyahu joint press conference in Washington. Standing at a podium alongside the podium of the president, the prime minister stated that in any peace agreement, I'm quoting him now, Israel must retain the overriding security control over the entire area west of the Jordan River. Now, Netanyahu has long affirmed that he would only allow the Palestinians what he called a state minus. He's long affirmed that most of the illegal Israeli settlements established since 1967 must remain in place, that all of Jerusalem belongs to Israel alone, and that Israel must keep somewhere between 50% and 60% of the West Bank, including the fertile Jordan River Valley. Boiled down to their essence, all of these statements translate into a regime of permanent occupation and colonization of what remains of Palestine. What is done with the Palestinians is secondary in this vision. As, and this is, I think, important, as Netanyahu laid out his preconditions, this was the main one, there was one other recognition of a Jewish state, Israel as a Jewish state, as he laid out his preconditions for a settlement that effectively ruled out a sovereign Palestinian state during this press conference, President Trump did not demur. He didn't object. He didn't say a word. Nor did he object when Netanyahu absurdly segued from biblical history to the colonial practice of the modern nation state of Israel. He wiped out 50 years of illegal occupation and land theft in the West Bank by saying, airily, this is Netanyahu speaking now, Jews are called Jews because they come from Judea. Jews are not foreign colonialists in Judea. So there's no occupation, there's no settlement, there's no colonization. This is people returning home to their ancestral land, and you can't object. The president said nothing, of course. Now, there is much, much more in the Trump-Netanyahu agenda for Palestine that is troubling. Though I've written in some of the op-eds that I've published since in the last couple of weeks that some of these things actually offer opportunities if people only know how to take them. But I think that on balance, much of this is troubling. But I want to stress tonight that not all the challenges faced by the Palestinians are going to come from increased collusion between the United States and Israel. The Palestinians are going to face challenges from within their own ranks. The entire Palestinian political and economic structure that was set up in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip since the 1993 Oslo Accords, which is a very long time now, if you think about it, 1993, 2017, this entire structure was predicated on the idea that it would evolve into the framework for a genuine, viable, contiguous, and sovereign Palestinian state. That was 24 years ago. That illusion that that would happen, which was held by many Palestinians and is clung to by others to this day, is now in tatters. It's very hard to believe that. Creation of this entire flawed political structure was also based on the naive premise that the United States had a vital interest in moderating Israeli behavior. That's clearly no longer the case under Trump, and that the United States had an interest in achieving a modicum of justice in the Middle East. Those premises, too, in my view, have been eroded by decades of bitter experience, and I think most people realize that the emperor is stark naked, whatever the emperor and his friend say. The Palestinian Authority that was set up by the Oslo Accords, ostensibly as part of an interim arrangement for Palestinian self-rule, it was supposed to go into extinction in 1997-98. There was not supposed to be something called a Palestinian Authority. There was supposed to be final status negotiations, which were to have led to permanent resolution of all outstanding questions, Jerusalem, water, settlements, borders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That did not happen. So this is an interim arrangement that has lasted now for 24 years. Far from serving the interests of the Palestinian people, this interim arrangement, in my view and in the view of many others, will continue to do them more harm than good. Few people understand, I think, that the colonization, of continuing colonization of Palestinian land, and the maintenance of what is going to become a 50-year-old military occupation in June, the longest occupation in modern history, would not be sustainable today without American, Israeli, and European sponsorship of the PA and the PA's U.S.-trained security forces. The PA's criminalization of any form of resistance, peaceful or otherwise, to Israel's colonization and what is now clearly a permanent military occupation have made it, in effect, a tool of collaboration with that occupation. The way that this ostensibly Palestinian institution, in fact, it's not a Palestinian institution. It's a Palestinian institution to the extent that the Gurkhas were a Nepalese institution or that Harkis were an Algerian institution. They were institutions of a colonial army which used them for whatever purposes. Britain used the Gurkhas or France used the Harkis in Algeria. So the way this ostensibly Palestinian institution operates against its own people provides a preview of the future that both Israeli and American officials now foresee for the Palestinians in the occupied territories, a future that is constricted, controlled, and void of sovereignty and self-determination. It's clear that the United States in the age of Trump and Israel in the age of Netanyahu will only work to strengthen this oppressive regime. They do not seem to have any interest in dismantling it or even moderating it. No help. How could this change if we have an Israeli and an American leadership that are growing closer together and both have moved their countries considerably to the right in recent years? I would argue that no help can be expected from the Arab world, most of whose undemocratic regimes do not represent their peoples. There are varying degrees of support for the Palestinians in different Arab countries, but in any case, their regimes don't represent them. And those that do have sympathy for the Palestinians are not really able to express that sympathy. This is especially true, this situation, given the failure of hopes for democratization that erupted at the beginning of the decade and given the collapse of any form of pan-Arab solidarity. The Arab world is racked not only by external intervention but by internal proxy wars where one Gulf principality is fighting another Gulf principality via the intermediary of Libyans or via the intermediary of Syrians or whatever, or where Gulf countries are engaged in much more seriously in opposing Iran than they are in doing anything else. Meanwhile, the absolute monarchies in the Gulf are moving ever closer to Israel. This is becoming closer and closer to an overt alliance, while Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen are torn by a combination of civil wars and proxy wars, where external powers manipulate local actors. Far from offering hope to the Palestinians, this dismal regional configuration, and I haven't even talked about terrorism. I haven't even talked about ISIS. I could talk about even more gloomy things if you want me to. Far from offering hope to the Palestinians, this dismal regional configuration only strengthens this Israeli government's hegemonic ambitions and its arrogance. In a region of total disarray, Israel stands as an even more powerful actor. In this grim context, I'm arguing tonight, the Palestinians face very stark choices. One option is to just muddle on. And for the moment, that's how their leadership, at least, seems to intend to proceed. Another option is for them to submit openly to the dictates of Washington and Tel Aviv, which on past form is just not going to happen. Whatever the leaderships want to do, I don't think most Palestinians will go along if what the leaderships want to do is to capitulate. The only other option, in my view, is for the Palestinians to rebuild their fractured national movement, which is in a state of complete disarray, probably in the worst shape it's been in since 1948, and to thoroughly redefine their objectives and their strategies and their modes of resistance to oppression. As many have argued, many Palestinians in the occupied territories and outside have argued, it's time for them to abandon the failed experiment of the PA, time for them to abandon the pretense of negotiation with an Israeli government that's interested only in dictating its own terms, and to abandon all forms of violence whose only effect is to harden the sway of the right wing over Israeli politics. If you sum up the policies of Fatah in Ramallah and Hamas in Gaza, they're doing these things that I've said have to be abandoned. It's time, moreover, to mobilize the vast energies, inventiveness, and capital of the Palestinian diaspora and of Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, who, by the way, are the Palestinians who understand best how Israel functions and what it is really up to. And it's time, finally, to stop thinking of Palestine as solely those small fragments that have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. On the conceptual level, and this is something that is incumbent not just on Palestinians, I think, but also on their supporters, it's time for people who advocate for Palestinian rights to learn that in struggles against both colonial settler regimes and racist systems like Jim Crow in the American South, the key to a successful approach was a laser-like focus on rights and equality. I cannot stress this enough. Equally important, it is time to stop mouthing empty slogans about a one-state solution and to begin to work out in detail the ways in which Palestinians and Israelis can finally be able to coexist in complete equality in a country they will ultimately have to share once it is free of the domination of one group over the other. In such a scenario, it is essential that the exercise of individual or group rights not impinge on or be at the expense of the rights of others, whether they are civil rights, human rights, religious rights, property rights, or national rights. There is no place in that small country for one group to say, our national rights take precedence over everything else. That is simply not going to work. Leave aside immoral, leave aside there's no basis for it, leave aside any other grounds for criticism. It won't work. You can't impose that. It's not possible to say, these people have these civil rights, these people have these, or this group of people, or these individuals, these property rights, these religious rights, and these people don't. You can't do that in the 21st century. You could do it in the 18th century. You could do it in the 19th century. But Israel is the outcome of a colonial project whose roots lie at a time when you could do that, when colonial was a good thing. There was a colonial office, the British colonial office. There was a school of Oriental and African studies which trained people for the British colonies. There's a French school, it still exists, that trained people for the French colonies. That was then. This is now. You can't do that anymore. And that, in effect, is part of the struggle. And it, revealing it as such, explaining it as such, addressing it as such, finding solutions to it in those terms, I think changes the entire way in which one looks at things. Now, this shift to a rights-based, equality-based approach can occur under various rubrics. And it doesn't matter which rubric is chosen, whether this involves binationalism, one state, two states, three states, doesn't matter, cantons, separate quasi-states, regional confederations, any other number of formulae are acceptable. The details are important. I'm not trying to dismiss that. But the key to such a future will have to be absolute equality of rights and of burdens for all members of both peoples, and that will involve ironclad constitutional and possibly international protection for these rights. Now, it's easy to say these things, and very hard, obviously, to implement them, but they require a a sort of paradigm shift, which is absolutely necessary if we're going to ever get out of the rut that we're in. It's going to be very hard to devise such a blueprint, and it will be very hard to rally the support for it of the various segments of the Palestinian people inside the country and in exile. Most Palestinians don't live inside historic Palestine. Most of them live in exile. Most of them live in places like Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, other Arab countries, Chile, the United States, a quarter of a million of them in Chile, a quarter of a million of them in the United States. Maybe, we don't know the numbers, but there are a lot of them outside, and there are many of them inside. And they have different, you know, orientations, and getting their consensus around something like this is not going to be very easy. Many of them are committed to the idea of an independent Palestinian state, which is understandable, because Palestinians have never enjoyed sovereignty in their own country. They've been constantly denied it throughout the last century. Equally difficult will be to convey this argument, this idea, in a convincing fashion to Arab, international, and most importantly to Israeli audiences. Only if both peoples can be convinced that they have a future in Palestine and Israel with equal rights and which is free of the oppression of one by the other will it be possible to change the dynamic that has prevailed between these peoples as they became peoples in the 20th century, for about a century. Only after this difficult effort can be launched can we really imagine the Palestinians envisaging a future free of oppression, and only after this sign of a process has been launched can there be a hope of real peace and of real security, not security imposed by force with the stronger, using the bayonet and walls and legal stratagems to force impose security, quote unquote, but real security and real peace is dependent on moving in this direction. Now, having thoroughly depressed you by offering you a gloomy picture of the situation and telling you that to get out of this, you know, we have to do something that's almost impossible, let me lighten things up a little bit. Because having, you know, depressed you and having indicated how very hard it's going to be to get out of this rut, I want to suggest that there are actually clear signs of change and real reasons for hope, at least in the United States and Europe. Let me explain. The change that I'm talking about is evidenced in an entirely new spirit where Palestine is concerned. Now, I'm old compared to most of you, and I remember the days when to use the word Palestine was a contested and difficult thing, an impossible thing in some environments. I mean, it would lead to violence in some environments. And so when I say an entirely new spirit where Palestine is concerned, I'm talking with a certain historical memory, and it's a historical memory that's based on the memory of my parents, who were involved in advocacy in New York City in the 40s, when it was even harder than when I was a university student or a graduate student. The change that I'm talking about can be witnessed on campuses, in many churches and some synagogues, in unions, in the publishing industry. Think about what's being published on Palestine. If you have any idea what was published 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, if you go back and look at how many books actually dealt with Palestine in an objective fashion a generation ago, you would be astonished at what has changed in just the American and British publishing industries. Even in the increasingly important non-mainstream media, there have been incredibly important changes with access to information that simply was unavailable a decade or two ago. Compared to a generation ago, we are at an entirely new place as far as discourse on Palestine is concerned. Now, ignorance, bigotry, and resistance haven't disappeared. You can sample it on the way out of Butler Library if you want. But 20 years ago, pretty much all that existed in American public life, or 30 years ago, pretty much all that existed in American public life, where Palestine was concerned, was ignorance, bigotry, and resistance. My point is, there is a lot else today. You can have access to real facts. You can actually learn about the situation there in ways that simply was not possible a generation or two ago. Today, there is much more openness to hearing other points of view. There is much more knowledge of the real situation in Palestine. If anybody has doubts, and they're reachable, say to them, go to Hebron and spend 6 hours. Any part of Hebron, it doesn't matter where or with whom. I mean, go to somebody who can protect you, but go to Hebron. Just spend 6 hours there. And if you're a sentient human being, you will come back changed. Because that in a microcosm is what's going on in the entire country. It's much worse in Hebron than in Nablus. It's worse in Nablus than it is in the little bubble of Ramallah, which is protected from reality in many ways. But that is the core of it in a certain way. And people are doing that. I mean, I know people, conventional, conservative, liberal members of the consensus in Chicago, people Chicagoans I knew, who went there, and they were just gobsmacked, to use the British expression. They came back changed people. I know many, many people. You can do that now. It's possible. And more people are doing it or are accessing real information about the real situation, not propaganda, actual information that enables them to make up their minds and to come to new understandings of things. There is also a dawning realization. I mean, we're now living in the age of Trump, and it's depressing to think that what was happening a year ago or 2 years ago or appeared to be happening a year ago or 2 years ago insofar as issues around racism, minorities, African Americans, Native Americans seems to be reversed. But those changes are irreversible in some respects. They're still there underneath the veneer that's going to be laid over them by this administration. There is a dawning realization that what Palestinians face has similarities. It's not identical, but it has similarities to past liberation struggles, not only to past liberation struggles in South Africa and elsewhere, but also to the efforts of Native Americans and African Americans to confront deep-seated prejudice and oppression. These are powerful new ways of understanding that are seeping into American public consciousness. And it's not every American who sees this, but it is a growing phenomenon. In addition, and I think this is actually important, in addition, the rise of a new wave of overt anti-Semitism that is one of the most dismal features of the age of Trump, and it is part of the age of Trump. This didn't just happen. This happened because of what was unleashed during this electoral campaign and by this new administration. The rise of this new wave of overt anti-Semitism is forcing many people to make connections that they never made before. This is forcing them to look askance at spurious accusations of anti-Semitism directed at proponents of Palestinian rights. When real old-fashioned Jew hatred is being expressed almost daily via, for example, swastikas in the New York City subways, via attacks on Jewish cemeteries where hundreds of tombstones are overturned, via bomb threats to Jewish community institutions. It is absurd, it's actually obscene, that some people whose concern this is focus instead of these outrages, these real anti-Semitic outrages, on shielding Israel's occupation and its colonization by falsely tarring people who oppose these things with the brush of anti-Semitism. And that connection is being made by a lot of ordinary people who don't think a lot about Palestine, but they know what anti-Semitism is. And when somebody says, well, somebody who's in favor of BDS is an anti-Semite, and that person happens to be Jewish, and you have actual anti-Semitic bigots drawing swastikas and knocking over tombstones, they say, that's the real thing. People are not stupid. They actually understand that. And I've talked to so many people who have very little commitment one way or another on this issue, but they make this connection. This spurious use of anti-Semitism is going to snare the people who are using it. And that's a really good thing. It's one of the only good things to come out of this horrible wave of anti-Semitism. Now, if you needed confirmation of the profound shift that is taking place in American attitudes towards Palestine and Israel, if you needed that, you only have to look at the signs that come from the secular religion of most Americans. Most Americans claim to be religious. This is a very religious country. But their real religion is actually football. Okay, whether they go to a synagogue or a church or a mosque or a temple or whatever, whatever they may do on a Friday or Saturday or Sunday or whatever, most of them, really, they worship at the temple of Sunday afternoon. I mean, that's really where they're, you know, hooked. You will have noticed that 12 football players were booked to go on a propaganda tour of Israel recently. Seven of the 12 declined to do so, because in the words of one of them, Michael Bennett, the man who I think was the leader of this, "I will not be used," he said, "by the Israeli government." Now, this is an echo of something that came up in a recent film on James Baldwin, "I am not your Negro." That's what Bennett was saying. You're not going to use me. You're not going to take me there, take me on a magical mystery tour, and turn me into a shill, which is what Israeli government ministers said they were going to do. And Bennett, not being stupid, read it and said, "No, you're not." And he carried the majority of this group with him. I think that reveals the way that things are beginning to come together in the American public imaginary. What Israel does to the Palestinians is increasingly being seen as akin to Jim Crow, as akin to apartheid, and the call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions are regarded as comparable to earlier boycotts in Montgomery, in Greensboro, and, of course, in South Africa. And those connections are just not that hard to make. You know, boycott is as American as apple pie. The Boston Tea Party was a boycott. They were tossing tea overboard because they were objecting to King George sticking a tax on it. It was a violent boycott. Heaven forbid. I'm not advocating violence of any sort or destruction of property. Heaven forfend. But that was a boycott. That's a founding event in the American psyche, folks. Boycott is as American as, I don't know, tea in Boston Harbor. Now, you might say these are just signs, you know, Michael Bennett, whatever. But I think that the changes, these changes in public discourse, are actually cumulatively beginning to produce an appreciable effect on public opinion. This is true, although where Palestine is concerned, the positions of much of the mainstream media and the positions of both the Democratic and Republican Party leaderships, the establishments of both parties, are frozen in the dark ages. They have not evolved, the Democratic leadership, the Republican leadership, the mainstream media. But there is evidence, whatever the politicians say, whatever Congress says, and Congress pretty much says whatever AIPAC wants, in spite of this, there's evidence that American public opinion is rapidly shifting away from uncritical support for Israel, and that Americans are becoming increasingly sympathetic to the cause of Palestinian freedom. According to a poll that was released by the Brookings Institution in December of last year, 60% of Democrats and 46% of all Americans support sanctions or stronger actions against Israel over its construction of illegal Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land. Savor those numbers. 46% of all Americans polled by Brookings. 60% of Democrats. The numbers are up from 49% and 37%. Respectively, in 2015. That is a remarkable increase and quite striking. There's no way to predict whether that trend would continue, but it is an important trend. Even more striking, a Pew poll released a little more than a month ago, in January, found that for the first time ever, the percentage of Democrats who side with the Palestinians is about equal to those who side with Israel. Think about that. The party that got 3 million more votes in spite of running a very unpopular candidate has now an equal number of party members who are as supportive of Palestine as there are party members who are supportive of Israel. That's quite, I think, quite striking. While liberal Democrats, people who self-identify as liberal Democrats, sympathize more with the Palestinians than with Israelis by a margin of 38% to 26%. Now, what does all this mean? It means that the base of the Democratic Party is out of tune, or put differently, the party leadership is out of tune with the base of the Democratic Party, because the party leadership is, first of all, is made up of older people. The base is made up of younger people. The leadership is wider. The base is more diverse. But it's also because the party leadership is beholden to big donors who've had a bigger and bigger influence on the party since Bill and Hillary Clinton founded the Democratic Leadership Council in 1985. Sounds like somebody's having fun. Okay, I'm almost done, guys. Now, all of this is occurring, we have to admit, at a time when the Republican Party, and its base especially, have become more and more supportive of Israel than ever before. They're driven in part by evangelical Christians who form an important part of the base of the Republican Party. Even while most of the Democratic Party establishment mouths the same stale pieties about Israel as before, there has in fact been a marked decrease in the bipartisan nature of public support for Israel. We could see this when Netanyahu inserted himself into American electoral politics with the connivance of Romney, who began to launched a campaign event actually in Israel side by side with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu coming to speak before Congress twice at the invitation of the Republicans and an insult to the president. This has decreased the bipartisan nature of support for Israel. Nevertheless, for the moment, with Republicans in control of the White House and in control of both houses of Congress, this means that Netanyahu can breathe easily. When that ceases to be the case, when Republicans no longer control both houses, when Republicans no longer control the White House, whenever that may be, as the Democratic Party base asserts itself against the unresponsive and unrepresentative leadership of the party on this issue, that situation could change dramatically. So what is a soothing situation for partisans of Israeli colonization, Israeli settlement, Israeli occupation, will be a lot less comforting. Over time, one can hope, these changes will eventually filter up to politicians and policymakers in Washington. In the meantime, it's up to civil society, it's up to individuals of conscience, including people who are resisting the wave of racism and right-wing extremism that we have to expect in the Trump era, to continue to push to expand the growing circle of those who believe in complete equality of rights for Palestinians and Israelis. The activism that seems to be so sporadic has actually helped to change the discourse. Don't underestimate the effect of things like Israeli Apartheid Week. Don't underestimate the effect of work of groups like JVP or SJP or others. The campaign to end the occupation. They're small. They have almost no funding. They don't have anything like the platoons of lawyers that the other side has. They don't have anything like the big billionaires funding everything they want to do that the other side has. But they are actually affecting change, which the other side is not succeeding in doing. And that's the remarkable thing. This means not being discouraged by well-funded, well-oiled campaigns against things like BDS. This means continuing campaigns like BDS. The reason that they are important is because they have had an impact on raising consciousness over these issues. I don't actually expect a significant boycott or divestment or governmental sanctions against Israel from this country in the foreseeable future. Some of those things will happen in Europe, where public opinion is more in tune with the politicians and where steps are being taken in that direction in various countries and by the EU. It doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is this has opened up the issue in ways that were unimaginable 10 years ago. That's why we've had these public opinion changes. The situation on the ground, of course. The greater accessibility to information, of course. The fact that people are younger and, like you, are smarter than their elders. It's true. You're more worldly and you have better access to certain diverse sources of information. Finally, it means that other forms of organizing and activism, things that don't come naturally to many of us. I mean, the idea of exerting pressure on my elected representative to live up to their ideals of freedom and whatever, it doesn't sit well. But if you watch what happens with the Affordable Care Act, you're going to see the grassroots burning the ground under the feet of those congressmen and women and senators who are going to try and deprive people of health care. That's just, ordinary grassroots activism to hold elected officials accountable. We have the potential to do the same thing on this issue. It's not true in every district. It's not true of every senator. But there are lots of them who are reachable. Lots and lots of them. That requires work. I'm not suggesting I'm going to do it. I am not. I have a day job. And I have a lot of other stuff to do. I'm not suggesting you all have to do it. But that should be in our minds. It works. It's already working. And it will continue to work. It's necessary because nobody else but us is going to do this kind of work. Nobody else is going to help hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law and for its systematic denial of Palestinian national human rights and for obstructing a future in which both of these peoples can live in genuine peace and real security. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Columbia University Professor Rashid Khalidi speaking on Palestine in the Age of Trump at Columbia University during Anti-Apartheid Week in the spring of 2017. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.